This is episode 49 of the Fifth Estate Podcast, Noah Rothman and how to be a conservative in the age of Trump. Getting a good night's sleep is easier said than done, especially if you think you just heard a noise downstairs. Think about it. What do you do in that situation? You could turn on the lights and keep watch. Check your kids' beds every hour. Sleep with one eye open. Or you can rest easy, knowing that your home and family are protected with SimpliSafe. When you install SimpliSafe Home Security System, you're arming your home with powerful sensors that actually tell you if a door opens or if a window breaks. There's a 105-decibel siren that alerts you at the top of trouble, and a dedicated team of security professionals watching over you 24/7, ready to send the police. With SimpliSafe, there are no long-term contracts, and around-the-clock monitoring is only $14.99 a month. So don't spend another night second-guessing your home's safety. Get SimpliSafe and get some rest. Go to simplysafe.com/ricochet and get a special 10% discount when you order today. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com. That's simplysafe.com/ricochet for 10% off your order. simplysafe.com/ricochet. All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am one of your co-hosts. I'm here with my other co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
Jay, I'm doing all right. A little bit fried. Went to the driving range like a true elitist. And unfortunately, it was 90 degrees, and I'm terrible at golf. So I'm, just a little bit frazzled.
Was there anything to drink?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Alcoholic beverages?
That made it all better.
Alcoholic beverages?
Yes, of course, alcoholic
okay,
beverages.
Well, I'm just...
what was I going to drink? Water?
You know how these company events can be sometimes. They want you to be teetotalers or something like that. Oh, we have pop over here for you to drink.
Not me.
Good. Glad
Not
to hear
day.
It. All right, so Neil, we are in the fourth month of the Trump presidency. And, there's lots of divisions. And forget about Republicans versus Democrats. It's conservative versus conservatives.
Yes, unfortunately, the divisions of the primary have carried over. The lines have shifted somewhat. And I think the general story here is complete disarray and chaos, not to mention backbiting. And the ruin of all that we have worked for all our lives, right?
Yeah. I mean, basically, there's three factions that are out there now. There's the pro-Trump Republicans or conservatives or whatever, and anti-Trump conservatives. And then there's anti-Trump conservatives.
Yes. Yes. And these the anti-Trump conservatives are those who find the protestations of the anti-Trump faction to be, shall we say, a bit tiresome.
Yes, yes, that's a good description of that. So we decided, let's talk about this, discuss it, and we brought in somebody who has written about this at length on Commentary Magazine. Noah Rothman is here to talk about this issue with us. Noah, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right,
thanks for being here, Noah.
Yeah. So, Noah, you wrote a pretty in-depth piece about how to be a conservative in the kind of the era, the age of Trump. Kind of take us through that. Give us a 50,000-foot view of what you were trying to do with that piece and what you were trying to get across.
Well, this had been bubbling up for several months, and I'm not the first person to get to it. I wrote this a long time ago, before it hit the stands, but you had this New York Times op-ed that did very well by former radio host Charlie Sykes, who kind of pinpointed and touched on an issue that resonated a lot, which is, you know, Republicans and conservatives in particular aren't defending any ideas anymore. There's just nothing on the table. There's no legislation that we're talking about. There's no grand reforms. There isn't even any principles or policy. We're all just rallying the wagons around a man. And that's not conservatism, and it's really unsatisfying. And as you noted earlier, you know, these divisions are sort of reappearing from the primary, where they sort of went underground for a little bit, but now they're bubbling up. Let's be very clear. Those divisions would not exist if this presidency was successful. It's a disaster. It has been a failure. It's not going to always be a failure, maybe, but it's been a failure so far. And as a result, conservatives are beginning to wonder what's gone wrong. And I try to illustrate what went wrong by not just talking about what we're talking about, but what we're not talking about, which is policy and principle, and not this nebulous universal philosophy of the Enlightenment and Burkeanism and all that, but day-to-day issues, what drives news cycles, what determines policy prescriptions in Washington, D.C., the kind of stuff that political combatants can latch onto and feel like they've gotten something that's relevant and revelatory. So, you know, it's sort of supposed to be a restatement of some things that people know they believe but sort of forgot they believe. Because nobody's talking about it anymore,
and that's why I found your article so compelling. You know, it was, you know, you lay out some concrete points and some things that conservatives ought to be promoting, ought to be opposing, a game plan, if you will. And that's something that, unfortunately, as you say, has been sadly lacking over the last 4 months. And I'd like to kind of just, if we can, just briefly go through each of these points. If you could just sort of give a 30-second summation just for the benefit of the listeners. You know, the first one you touch on is the disaster of central planning. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, this is relevant now because we're sort of talking about a big infrastructure bill, which is something Donald Trump wants to do. He wants to do sort of a Bernie Sanders, throw $1 trillion at something and just see glittering new airports and roadways and bridges spring up from nothing. And these show projects are the kind of stuff that, you know, appeals to Soviet bureaucrats. What conservatives don't appreciate in big centrally planned projects like this is how they're inevitably very wasteful. They're usually alienating. They result in ridiculous bungles, and they alienate and dissociate people from their communities. One of the things that people talk about now as though it's sanctified is, for example, the Eisenhower National Highway System, which was a defense project. And again, a very important project. But people have forgotten how much property was seized and destroyed, the people that were relocated, the corruption and the horse trading that typified it. All that's been whitewashed away. And it's just one of many examples of how central planning, bureaucratic planning, the elimination of the community is something that has been embraced by the populist right, but it's really a leftist ideology. It's not conservative.
Textbook Keynesianism, I think you called it. So.
That was Donald Trump, who continually, repeatedly says we should prime the pump, even though he thinks he just invented that the other day. He's been saying it for quite a long time. And yeah, it's Keynesianism, but without the crisis. Keynesianism is a way to address a lacking government growth by stimulating spending, by injecting capital and liquidity into the economy. And there needs to be a crisis because of it. There is no crisis now. We have full employment. We have every metric says there's no recession on the horizon. But there's a group of Trump voters who believe that Washington doesn't believe in them. And so they demand a grand, futile gesture on their behalf. And that is what they're looking for. They're looking for an injection of liquidity into the economy just to say, we know you're there.
Let's talk about the era of government mandates. Now, for 7 years, 8 years, Republicans ran explicitly against Obamacare and its mandate to buy health insurance. But now we seem to have sort of gotten very quiet. Talk about that.
Yeah, because it's really unpopular to say what conservatives used to believe, which is that government can't do health care. Government cannot make healthcare efficient. It cannot expand access to healthcare in terms of quality or cost effectiveness. And in the long run, government healthcare will help fewer people than the free market would. That's really unpopular to say now, in part because the paradigm has shifted as a result of Obamacare. But this was something that the Tea Party was rallying in the streets about in 2009. They said one of their complaints was that if you do this, you'll never undo it. You can't undo the extension of what is essentially a new welfare program because it just becomes too politically popular. And one of the things that they also warned about was that this will snowball and expand and eventually become something akin to a single-payer program because this program is designed to fail. They're not wrong about that either, and we're going to get to that place. And finally, they warned that the regulation of healthcare and creation of a federal healthcare mandate necessitates the regulation of every daily activity that you engage in, because every daily activity that you engage in affects the bottom line as a healthcare consumer when it becomes a national priority. And this is the slippery slope on which we're on. We're only at stage one, but every one of their predictions has come true, and it doesn't seem like we're going to be able to pursue a conservative position, a conservative vision on healthcare reform, because it's just not popular.
Well, and I wonder if the sort of impotence of the Tea Party movement in rolling back this mandate and arresting the tide there, I wonder if that fueled a little bit of the populist rage that, you know, fueled the Trump campaign. So the next point that you raise, which is, I think, one that is highly debatable on the right, is the need for strong, sometimes preemptive national defense. Now, I myself, I was in high school when 9/11 happened, and that sort of set my worldview. I am not unopposed to preemptive military strikes when the situation warrants, but there's not much taste for that on the right anymore.
No, and the record in Iraq is to blame for that. And there were a lot of problems in Iraq and a lot of poor decision making that went a long way to poisoning the public and the right in particular against that idea. But it is nevertheless the case that it is a moral imperative to prevent the death of Americans and allies before they can be killed. The opposite, you know, the alternative to that is to wait for a provocation which will necessitate death on your side. That is immoral. And Americans, particularly conservatives, no longer talk about preemptive defense in those absolutist, self-righteous terms. Understandably so. But that doesn't render it untrue or unnecessarily excessive. I think that it is, and it's one of those things that we're going to have to face sooner rather than later when it comes to developing threats like the nuclear program in North Korea and Iran. We're one day going to face the choice of having to preempt this program or allow for the possibility that North Korea could deliver a miniaturized nuclear device with no warning time on 30,000 American heads. And we won't allow that to happen because it would be immoral and it would be a threat to American national security. So we're going to have that debate sooner rather than later. So I say, why not start now?
I can't differ with you on that. Now, the next one, I think, is the really hard sell, and this is the necessity of failure. What is that about? Why is failure sometimes necessary?
Yes, and I cite Megan McArdle, Bloomberg contributor. Her book, The Upside of Down, is all about this, and it's really quite good. And essentially, the premise here is that Americans must be free to be outbid, go under, and to rebound and reinvent themselves on their own terms. That, too, has become a terrible thing to consider. And we're not just talking on a macro level. For example, the TARP assets that were distributed to the three big auto manufacturers, some of them, you know, Ford took a bailout. It didn't need it anyway. People thought that GM and Chrysler didn't need that bailout necessarily because they would go under and restructure, which they did anyway. But they would have had a lot more leverage and workforce, which could have been more efficiently allocated. And then Donald Trump got a lot of praise, for example, for when he was in the president-elect, and they worked out the carrier deal, quote-unquote, which created some tax incentives for a couple of United Technologies-owned manufacturers in Indiana to stay there. But those workers could have been more efficiently reallocated in the workforce. They could have probably made more money. $65 million was lost to United Technologies, which will be passed on to the consumer. And a couple of months later, UT announced that those tax reliefs would go to manufacturing, or rather automating its manufacturing plants, because you can't repeal economics. These are sort of like laws of economics that conservatives used to know intuitively, and even though some of them are harsh and they have sharp edges, that doesn't make them wrong or unjust or even unwelcome. And that's sort of something that I think conservatives don't talk about anymore.
Yeah.
And by the way, all of this, all of these conservative assumptions that people don't say anymore, has allowed fringe provocateurs and charlatans to caricature themselves and make these wild, outlandish, provocative statements that they lampoon as conservatism. And that creates, you know, skepticism on the health on the part of healthy outside observers to what they think conservatism is, because if they think it's this nutty, brutal vision of what these people who tour campuses and want, you know, just students to go out and set things alight in order to protest them and get their book deals, you know, more money. That's mm-hmm. the sort of thing that turns people off to conservatism. So one of the points of this piece, which I'm sort of digressing here, is that conservatives need to take ownership again of these policies that may be a little bit unpopular in the broader sense in order to stop people who don't cherish them from perverting them.
You got two more points here. I want to get through these really quickly. And we've got a rational immigration policy. Now, every time we talk immigration prior to Trump, it was nasty. And now in the age of Trump, I can't imagine that we have very good prospects for having a rational immigration debate, let alone an eventual policy.
Probably not. And I don't know whether or not I'm so enthusiastic about this, but it is nevertheless the case that conservatives used to believe and should believe that any sound immigration policy must prioritize American interests. That immigration into the United States is not to benefit the immigrant, but to benefit the nation. That, in the age of Trump, has come to sound chauvinistic and exclusionary. But it's not. It never was. This was always the policy of any nation that accepts immigrants. You also mentioned
the resettlement of refugees.
Right, because that's in America's national interest.
It serves a foreign policy interest, you know. And this is the other aspect of you know, immigration. It's not just about people taking, you know, their jobs. It's about how we are perceived in the world. It really speaks to our national character.
Yeah, that's a tool of foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Like any other tool of foreign policy, that is something that is useful in some circumstances and not useful in other circumstances. And the case needs to be made to the public when it's useful. When it's not, it cannot simply be assumed that Americans are going to accept this at face value. They need to be communicated with. But yes, refugee resettlement, at-risk populations can benefit the United States. Absolutely. So can seasonal labor and skilled visa work. I mean, just ask Donald Trump. He went to the mattresses to defend seasonal unskilled labor to work at his resort when in the off season. So, I mean, these things are obviously necessities for American economic growth and America's economic health, but it needs to be discussed rationally. And the fact is that before Donald Trump got in this race, there was total consensus on the part of every Republican running for the presidency, and there were like 47 of them. All of them had a consensus immigration policy, and there was a vacuum because the rest of the Republican electorate didn't really buy that. And Donald Trump filled that vacuum, and that's a hard lesson for Republicans to learn, but they do need to learn that they have constituents that need to be heeded to. Even if they don't 100% agree with their interests, they need to be talked to.
I agree. Yeah, your last point is particularly delicious to me.
And me.
The superiority of incrementalism. Now, this is an argument that I have had several times, especially in the latter half of the Obama administration, when the talk was, we are going to repeal Obamacare. Boom. Yes, it's happening. And anything less than full repeal, if you talked about, the political reality, which is that repeal is not going to happen because Obama will veto it, yada, yada, yada. This was a betrayal of conservatism. You know, I always likened it to everybody wants to score a touchdown. But in this game, you only ever advance the ball a few yards. You never score a touchdown. Nobody scores a touchdown.
So, yeah, that's a great analogy. And Obamacare was a disaster. So why would we want to emulate that? And that's the thing about comprehensive legislation. It's almost never comprehensive, and it's always full of unintended consequences, and it's always really disruptive to the social fabric, and so people resist it. Even if you're appealing something that's comprehensive, you know, that meets with resistance. But when all these things sort of happened in the 111th Congress in 2009, 2010, there was all these big financial reforms, regulatory reforms, healthcare reforms, and it just seemed like things were moving very fast. And that was part of the reason why you had such a backlash in 2010. But the right's attachment to this baby step approach to legislation seemed like unilateral disarmament. Like, we were facing this threat that we weren't prepared to meet with the amount of firepower that we were receiving. And that developed into this theory of how Republicans don't fight, and we need to have more fight. Everybody needs to fight more. Whether or not you're fighting for something that's valuable.
Yeah, let's just shut down the government, because that'll show people we can govern.
Well, even when it doesn't get shut, like, you know, Ryan's first budget, and I wrote about this. It was funny because as soon as I saw your, you know, the superiority of incrementalism, I had written last year in National Review something about, you know, the conservative intransigence brought around Trump. And it was when Ryan's first budget passed, you know, there was $680 billion in tax breaks. There was the elimination of the crude oil exports. There was a couple of Obamacare taxes were postponed. And yet when that budget passed, the Dump Ryan hashtag made its, you know, its appearance on Twitter. And, you know, he was an Obama puppet, you know, and they just completely forgot about whatever they could get in there, because I can't even remember. I guess it was they didn't defund Planned Parenthood or something.
And that's the thing, is that conservatives undervalue the amount of work that liberals have put into moving the goalposts here. Healthcare didn't just happen. They had been working towards stripping it of controversy for 30 years. And conservatives are really dismissive of their own victories. This is a much more conservative country than it was 25 years ago. It leaps and bounds more conservative. But if you talk to the average Trump supporter, particularly of a certain age, they will talk about how this country's gone to hell in a handbasket and how it's completely gone over the edge as far as cultural liberalism goes. And it's just not true. I mean, if you just look at abortion, divorce rates, marriage rates, for example, these sort of things, they're not going necessarily in the wrong direction. And we're also seeing a lot more decentralization and less reliance on big government liberal policy achievements than we would have seen in the 20th century. And I don't think anybody remembers what the 20th century was like. We had nationalization was a big issue, was a big part of the Democratic platform for most of the 20th century. And that sort of stuff is discredited now. So these are things that, you know, Democrats or Republicans, conservatives especially, just don't give a lot of credit to. And I think they should.
I agree. So, okay. No, we're going to what?
Oh, I thought you were going to say something.
I was going to say something.
Well, say it, man.
I said we were going to take a break for a few minutes as we listen to a word from one of our sponsors. Neil, is that okay? Can the sponsors get in here?
Oh, yes. I like breaks. I approve of this.
Yes, because they help us. That's the kind way of putting what our sponsors do. So let's go and hear from one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Hey there, folks, it's Neil Dewing, and I want to take a minute to tell you about our friends at Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club is the smarter choice. You will get a great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered right to your door. It's really a no-brainer. No longer do you have to schlep to the store to buy a cheap disposable razor that gives you a cheap shave. Neither do you have to spend a fortune on razors with gimmicky shaving tech that you don't need. I myself use Dollar Shave Club. Now, for several months out of the year, I go bearded. But when I do shave, I find Dollar Shave Club delivers a smooth, sleek, really quite attractive result. And when I use my Dollar Shave Club Executive Razor with their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter, the blade glides ever so gently and gives me such a smooth shave. Plus, their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter is transparent for a more precise shave, which helps prevent ingrown hairs and fights razor bumps. Now, listeners to the Fifth Estate can make the smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club. For a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. After that, razors are just a few bucks a month. This is a $15 value for only $5. In your first month box, you get an awesome weighty handle, a full cassette of four cartridges, and a tube of their shave butter. After your first month, replacement cartridges ship automatically at their regular price. There are no hidden fees and no commitments. cancel anytime you like. You can only get this offer exclusively at dollarshaveclub.com/fifth. That's dollarshaveclub.com/fifth.
And we're back after that fantastic and refreshing break. We're going to shift away from discussion of Noah's article, which, by the way, you should read at commentary online or in the print edition. And we're going to turn the talk to the conservative divisions that have emerged in the age of Trump. You know, it's one thing to be able to articulate conservative policies and make an attempt to sell those to people, but it's very difficult to do that when you're busy fighting one another because of the erratic behavior of the president. And that's what we seem to have right now. And gentlemen, tell me if you agree with this. I think broadly speaking, we have three factions that are pretty loud on the right now. We have the pro-Trump faction, who are supporters of the president. We have the anti-Trump faction, which do not support Trump, and in fact wish for his ouster in many ways. And then we have, as a reaction to the anti-Trump, we have the anti-anti-Trump, for lack of a better term. And these people are critical of the methods of the anti-Trump faction, the methods and the general tone, I would say, of the anti-Trump faction. So let's talk about that, because I think it's causing a bit of friction in the conservative movement, and I don't think that bodes well.
Well, I would weigh in here, and I think all those terms are self-appointed, self-assumed, and they're misnomers. The people who are quote-unquote pro-Trump are really North Korea fanatics for whom the president can do no wrong, and that he is a deity come to earth. Seriously. And then you have the anti-Trump people who, if you're on the right, they're really just Trump skeptical. I see more people who are anti-Trump being honestly praiseworthy of the president when he makes decisions they like. For example, executing military strikes on the Assad regime, that was praised by the left and right. Appointing justices to and people to lower court positions, and some cabinet picks. I mean, he's made some really good cabinet picks, and I consider myself in the Trump skeptical camp. But I wouldn't consider myself anti, because I'm not reflexively anti all the time. I think most people would say that too. The anti-anti-Trump case is just pretty much pro-Trump. Like, they're not lunatics about it, but they are defensive of the president, particularly when he's under attack from left, right, center, doesn't matter. And they're relatively supportive of the things he's done in office. So I would consider this pro, skeptical, and insane.
Interesting. Why do you suppose the pro, skeptical, and insane?
Well, the insane, yes,
those are the North Korea types.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he thought you had very that good. Reversed.
Well, let's talk a bit more about the pro-Trump, aka anti-anti-Trump side. You know, why do you suppose there is this defensiveness about Trump? Why do they feel the need to rise to his defense when he does something that, say, in the Obama administration, they might have criticized?
Right. Okay, so here's an example of that. We are in the middle of week two of Scandalpalooza. There's scandals all over the place dropping on Donald Trump, on his administration. The administration is on his heels. Minutes before we convene this, the Department of Justice appointed a special prosecutor to look into the Russia issue. It's not going well. And one of the things that was frustrating the anti-anti-Trump side was the fact that so many reporters were leaning on and relying on anonymous sources. Anonymous sources, we are told, is part of the false news, or fake news rather, phenomenon, in which there's a lot of news that is untrustworthy, and particularly because reporters are so anti-Trump, they're reporting things with little sourcing that they would never run with in the Obama era because they supported Obama. It's not entirely unfair to say that the press has shed a lot of credibility in the Trump era because they ran with so many things, particularly on Twitter, as they've run with so many things that have proven to be false. after the case. They're a little better at that, but the first 2 months of this were just insane, and they did shed a lot of credibility. The notion that anonymous sources, however, is somehow suspect is nonsense. Anonymous sources, not just to reporters, but to IIG's office, broke the IRS scandal and the Department ISIS's links to it. It broke the surveillance on AP journalists. It broke the fact that ISIS intelligence was being watered down for Barack Obama. Nobody had a problem with anonymous sources then. So this is really just a defense mechanism. And why would you need a defense mechanism if what is being alleged, like the fact that Jim Comey might have been leaned on to drop the investigation into Mike Flynn, is a really big deal? Why would you need a defense mechanism unless you were objectively pro-Trump?
Right. It seems to me that, you know, and I don't want to say that, you know, the anti-Trump or the Trump skeptical side is the most rational, because, as you say, there are some fair criticisms to be levied against the media for their conduct during the Trump administration. You know, you can't treat everything as if it's an 11, and then expect people to react when something really bad does happen. But it does seem to me that there's just a little bit of a lack of discernment when it comes to knowing when you should defend Trump, even if you are a partisan, and knowing when you really don't need to pick up arms and actually defend him. It's not that you have to be critical. You just don't need to exert effort on his behalf.
Right. And I mean, I'm hesitant to even say this because I don't know if it's universally applicable. In fact, I don't think it is. But there is sort of a class envy thing there, too, as though there's sort of a defensiveness about coastal elites and generally, you know, opinion from members of an establishment, whatever that establishment might be, political, cultural, media, what have you, that there's this sort of a chip on their shoulder that informs just about every reaction to every story that has little to do with the story and much more to do with this sense of position that they occupy, status and credentialism. And that's hard for me to overlook. And I do see it a lot.
Well, I think one of the problems is that I'm having in all of this is the... Look, I totally agree with keeping the media honest. And I've been critical of the media at times with what they've done with Donald Trump. And I get that. But what I cannot stand and what I do not like and what I'm not really tolerant of is when something happens and then the story is correct, that the response is, well, the media didn't do this when Obama was president, you know. And it's like, if you want to be critical of the press, of, you know, what they're doing now, what they may not have been doing with Barack Obama. And I think it's true. I think, you know, a perfect example is the I don't think the press did enough digging or enough getting into, you know, when the Justice Department was going through the Associated Press's phone calls or phone records when they designated James Rosen as a unindicted co-conspirator in an Espionage Act case. You know, there was this initial outrage, and then it just kind of died down, you know, and I would venture to guess that if Donald Trump had done that and his attorney general did that, it would blow up like there was no tomorrow. So I get that. But if the idea is to defend Trump by de facto sitting there saying, well, what about what happened with Obama? I mean, I said this earlier. I said, we just spent 8 years of listening to a president blame whatever problems that he had on the previous administration. And now here we are 4 months into the Trump administration. These screw ups, a lot of which are real, are being, you know, brushed aside by saying, well, the media didn't do this when Obama was president. And that's what kind of gets me. And that goes back to the what Neil referred to as the anti-Trump, what you just said are the pro-Trump people.
Right.
It's, you know, yes, keep the media honest. But don't start making excuses for Donald Trump by saying, well, what about?
Well, I think it's an easy thing to fall into, honestly, when there isn't much substance to defend. And, you know, I think it maybe should give people some empathy for the Obama administration and their lackeys, wouldn't you say? It's difficult. It's difficult to defend somebody who's screwing up and you know they're screwing up.
Well, if you're, yeah, it is, absolutely. If you're a Trump skeptical, your primary source of frustration is the fact that Republicans now have total control of the federal government, almost total control of half the union, and they can't seem to get anything done, and in part because this administration keeps stepping on its own toes and opening its mouth when it shouldn't be. And that is extremely frustrating. But if you were in that camp of reflexively defending the administration no matter what, yeah, I would get a little irritated at the fact that the president keeps undermining you. Over the course of the last 2 weeks, you know, a lot of people on that side of the thing of the camp went to the mattresses to defend Jim Comey's firing based on the recommendations in Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's memo, only for the president to appear on NBC News with Lester Holt and say the memo had nothing to do with it. He was going to fire him anyway. Yesterday, or a couple of days ago, we had National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster appear on television and say that this didn't happen. It was with referring to the notion that Russia was provided with some sort of intelligence from a foreign country, which we now understand to be Israel, on a lark. It didn't happen, he said. Well, Donald Trump went on Twitter 12 hours later and said, not only did it happen, but I'm perfectly within my rights to do it. So H.R. McMaster goes under the bus. And it was infuriating to see conservatives tell me with childlike earnestness that the man from the government told me it didn't happen, so it must be true. What the heck happened to your skepticism, conservatives? This isn't you. This is sycophancy.
Right. And I mean, that's not to take away from H.R. McMaster, who very well is an honorable man. And somebody made a good point saying, look, what he did may not have been in the interest of Donald Trump, but in the interest of national security, to still kind of like, you know, kind of try and set this up to, you know, to a point where to say, you know, this didn't happen, but in a sense to protect national security, not necessarily protect Donald Trump. But at the same time, you could tell, and there was news that came out that said he worked with White House counsel to issue his statement. Why would he need to discuss with a lawyer what his statement to the public was going to be, unless they wanted to make sure it was crafted in a way that allowed them to deny the story, but at the same time not actually deny what came out. You know, it was, you know, what he said was the specific words, as the story as written is false. And as written means you're, as far as I'm concerned, that you're taking issue with part of the story. You're not actually, you know, the denial of what happened. He denied things that weren't alleged is what he did. But because from him, people were ready to say, yeah, that's exactly what happened.
In a sense, and Noah, let me know if you agree with this, because I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. In a sense, isn't the sort of thing that's happening to people who have staked their credibility on defending Donald Trump, who then immediately betrays them, and undermines not only their credibility, but the ideas that they do support. Isn't that sort of what's going to happen to conservatism on a macro level? Is people are going to identify conservatism with Republicans and Donald Trump in particular, and it will make it that much harder for the ideas that you discussed in your article to be sold to the voting public. In fact, it may make them absolutely repellent.
Yeah, that was the fear expressed. That was the underlying central fear expressed by those who opposed Donald Trump's candidacy, opposed his nomination, and later opposed his election to the presidency. Conservatives in particular were afraid that Trump would bastardize and pervert conservatism, because the appeal of partisanship and the demands of partisanship are so strong that inevitably conservatives would run to his side, surrender conservative principle, and embrace whatever it was Trumpism happened to be in that moment. And we have sort of seen that. And it is frustrating, particularly because it's kind of vacuous. I mean, there's just, as we said in the last segment, there's just really nothing there for you to latch your head around or your hands around. So you end up arguing class consciousness, or, you know, what about X? What about Obama? Performing media criticism in lieu of actually arguing a substantive position of the government. And that's essentially where conservatism on the side of Trump come hell or high water ends up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's corrupting. And there's no other word for it. It's corruption. Whether or not it's satisfying or lucrative, I don't know. I can't say. But
I mean, I don't think
certainly
that
not intellectually rigorous.
Yeah, I don't think it even matters. I mean, I just think it's absolutely demeaning, and it must be somewhat demoralizing to stake your credibility on something that the president contradicts the next morning in a tweet. You know, to put yourself out there, knowing the climate, knowing that people are quite charged with emotion, and there's a lot of judgment to be, you know, to be had, and then immediately the president he uses you and discards you. Why keep going back?
I can't answer that question.
Sorry to take it down a notch, fellas.
Well, it's one of those questions where you say, you know, I mean, and this is the thing that's amazing. I'm working on something and actually had to go out and I was talking to some Trump voters over the last couple of days and trying to get a gauge of, you know, were they Trump supporters or were they people who voted for Trump because, you know, he was the one against Hillary. And there really was a wide range of views. One lady I met and was very nice, you know, has been there. She goes, I've been with Trump since he was coming down that escalator, you know. Whereas others are just kind of like, yeah, well, it was him or Hillary, you know. So there is that kind of opinion. But I have to say, you know, it's like, it's true. How many times has this got, like, you just today? Well, I mean, it was reported last week, but then it was confirmed today. He's not going to move the embassy, the Israeli embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, like he promised. It's another disappointment. So how do you sit there and continually make up these excuses to sit there and say, well, that's because of this, you know, China's not a currency manipulator, you know?
Yeah. At what point do you just say, yeah, he lied about all that stuff. He lied. And that's the bottom line, is he did not intend to do it. And he didn't try. If he did intend to do it, he didn't try very hard.
Well, the part that gets me is that when you delve into that and people say, well, he's changing his views on certain things. And isn't that good if the circumstances have changed? And it's like, well, not really, because we had other Republican candidates who were arguing the exact opposite at the time. You know, we're saying China's not manipulating their currency.
Well,
right,
here's
now
the thing. No one wants to admit they were sold a bill of goods, right? No one wants to admit they were really gullible. But the thing is that you were, and we all know you were. And so that's humiliating. I've seen more intellectual honesty from the alt-right than the average Trump supporter. The alt-right is miserable, and they're honest about it. They think that they were duped. They think this guy has completely led them astray, that he's no longer with them when it comes to everything from their immigration policy to funding the border wall to, you know, getting right with the Jews to, you know, a no more aggressive interventionism abroad. Like, they feel like they were tricked. Trump supporters, the average Joe Trump supporter on the street who ends up in one of those, you know, columns where the reporter from Manhattan, who's never ended up in you know, the border of Kentucky and Ohio, descends on this town for a second, profiles the old folks at the coffee shop, and zooms back home. Those guys, I don't see a lot of intellectual honesty from. And frankly, they should be reading columns about what other people think. I'm completely tired now of what the Trump supporter in Conshohocken, in Pennsylvania thinks, because he doesn't change his opinion, and he's one of 40% of the public that supports Donald Trump. He's got an average job approval now almost under the 40%, according to RCP. It's only going down. Why are we still talking to Trump supporters when their political relevance is at a nadir? What we should be talking about is the center of the country, who's going to be deciding the next election, and they're not happy.
That is a great point. That is a great point. Maybe all those folks in Pennsylvania ought to read an article about international trade and how it benefits people, how free trade benefits them.
Yeah, or they should be reading an article about how people who work on, for example, the Newark docks, what do they think? Or they should frankly be reading about, investors on the 44th floor of Goldman Sachs in Jersey City.
Well,
what do they think?
Yeah, well, let's start with saying they should read Noah Rothman in the latest issue of Commentary. How about that?
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
You heard it here, folks. Get out there, pick up an issue at your local newsstand or read online.
Local newsstand? Do we even have those anymore? You have to go to Barnes and Noble.
I don't know. I'm an elitist. I don't mingle.
I know. And well, you know, it stinks. It's like I actually have to go. I've gotten into this thing now, and we're just a little aside here, a little discussion where I've actually started buying more print magazines. Commentary is one of them. The only complaint that I have is the Barnes and Noble that's close by never has it. I've always got to go to the one that's like 20 miles away to get it. But it's worth it to read Noah's articles.
It is. It is. Jay, that aside reminded me that we have one more question to ask Noah before we let him go.
Is he still here?
I'm still here.
All right.
Of course he's still here.
I thought he maybe ran away. He's like, oh, no.
Bated breath. No, we do. We have one final question for you, and it is a bit of a gotcha. And we spring this question or something very much like it on all our guests. We don't warn you beforehand what it's going to be.
It's important.
But I will. It is important. It's vital. And the way you answer, it matters. So please, be honest. Is the television show Seinfeld overrated?
No. No. Seinfeld is not overrated.
Win.
Seinfeld is a very good show.
Go on.
Well, I mean, it was a groundbreaking show. And frankly, there's very few programs that I think hold up 20 years later. I can sit down in front of a rerun of Seinfeld and enjoy it and occasionally chuckle. Not even to myself, like a chuckle emerges from my lips despite myself. And I can't say that about any other show. So it's an extraordinarily good show.
And it's what's great about it is that even the stuff that's dated is still funny. So when you have shows that deal with like answering machines, they're still funny.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, it probably doesn't resonate with a younger generation, but still resonates with me.
Ah. Neil's disappointed. He actually was on a streak there, I think, 2 weeks
I was
in a
on,
row.
I was on a streak. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Jay and I disagree on this question.
I think this will be the final one. I think we have to move on to something else. I think this has probably outlasted some of the other ones.
Oh, yeah. Now that Noah broke the tie.
Now right? The tie. I don't think it's that close,
Neil.
It's
time to find another question.
Don't think it's that close. Well, anyway. All right. So, Noah Rothman, commentarymagazine.com. Check out his writing there. Also, like I said, go ahead and buy the stuff on the newsstand. It's great. You know, there's most of it's kind of, you know, online versus a magazine. But hey, you know what? Sometimes it's nice to hold a magazine in your hand. You know? Right?
Yeah, it's pretty. It's glossy. And there's a lot of great stuff in there. Abe Greenwald is in there as well. He has a great cover article, and he's a genius. J.D. Vance, who wrote Hillbilly Elegy, is in there reviewing a book for us. A lot of great stuff.
Great. All right. Terrific. All right. So, Noah Rothman, thank you very much for joining us, having a great discussion. Appreciate it. Hey, you know what we didn't talk about before, Neil?
Yes, I do, Jay. I'm keenly aware that we did not ask our listeners to go onto iTunes and give us a rating and a review. And
Tell us how much you love us.
I know. We need it. We need it, guys, because let me tell you, it's really how I get out of bed in the morning. It's the first thing I do. I check that iPhone. I go right there to the iTunes page, and I say, did anyone rate us? And yes, they did. All right. I'll get up today. So come on.
See, it allows Neil to get out of bed and start his day. So, yeah, please go over there. Go to iTunes. Leave us a rating. Leave us a review. Subscribe to this podcast. And if you go to the website, fifthestate.us, you can subscribe there on iTunes or any other kind of podcast application that you use. So we appreciate that. And anyway, that's going to do it for this edition of the Fifth Estate. I am Jay Caruso for Neil Doing. We'll see you next time on the Fifth Estate.